This is disc number 11.
Nikki lifted an eyebrow as she looked back at Richard. The key just shut down the shields to the door. I've never seen such a thing before. It must have been designed to give access to trusted aides or scholars who weren't gifted, Richard guessed. He turned back to Berdine as she worked at opening the lever on the heavy door. By the way, did you learn anything else about Barakas? Not much, she said, looking back over her shoulder, except that Magda Cirrus, the woman who became the first confessor, had once been married to him. Richard could only stare at her. How does she know these things? He muttered to himself. What? Berdine asked. Nothing, he said, dismissing it with a wave before flicking the hand at the door. So, what is it that you found in here? Something that connected with what Kolo said. You mean about this book that wasn't supposed to be copied? Berdine merely gave Richard a sly smile as she tucked the key down into a pocket inside the top of her outfit, then pushed open the black door. Chapter 29. Inside, three tall windows that made up most of the far wall lit the room with a gloomy late afternoon light. Rain pattered against the glass and ran down in snaking rivulets. The walls of the small room were lined with bookshelves made of golden oak. There was only enough space in the center of the room for one simple oak table that was in turn only large enough for the four wooden chairs, one on each side. In the center of the table sat an unusual four-lobed lamp, offering each empty chair its own light from a silvered reflector. With a sweep of her arm, Nikki sent a spark of her gift into the four wicks. The flames swelled, lending golden warmth to the small room. Richard noticed that, despite the way the palace spell diminished the power of any but a Rawl, she seemed to have had no trouble lighting the lamps. Berdine went to the shelves to the right of the door. Near the part of Kolo's journal where he mentioned the book that wasn't supposed to be copied, I think he might have been implying that the men who didn't trust Barakas were the ones who made the copies. I think that's who he meant anyway, but I'm not sure. He refers to them as the half-wits from Yankley's Yarns. Nikki spun around to Berdine. Yankley's Yarns? Richard looked from Nikki's astounded expression to Berdine's. What's Yankley's Yarns? He asked.
A book, Berdine said.
Richard turned a questioning look on Nikki. Nikki huffed in exasperation. It's more than just a book, Richard. Yankley's Yarns is a book of prophecy. A very, very peculiar book of prophecy. It predates the Great War by 7 centuries. The vaults at the Palace of the Prophets had an early copy of it. It was a curiosity that every sister studied in the course of her education about prophecy. Richard peered around at the books lining the shelves. What was so peculiar about it? It's a book of prophecy that is nothing but gossip and hearsay. Richard turned back to her. I don't get it. Well, Nikki said, pausing to find the right words, it wasn't believed to be prophecy about future events, exactly. It's actually believed to be prophecy about future gossip, so to speak. Richard rubbed his tired eyes as he sighed. He looked up at Nikki again. You mean to say that this Yankley fellow wrote predictions about gossip? When Nikki nodded, all he could do was ask, why? Nikki leaned in a little. That's the very question to which everyone wanted an answer. Richard shook his head as if to clear the cobwebs. You see, there are many things that are secret. Nikki gestured toward Berdine. Like this business with the book that wasn't supposed to be copied. Those kinds of secrets often remain secret because people go to their graves without ever revealing them. That's why when we study historical records, we sometimes are not able to solve mysteries. There just isn't any information to be had. But sometimes, there are little tidbits of information floating around, things people saw or overheard, and the people who saw or overheard them start to gossip about those tasty tidbits. There were sisters at the Palace of the Prophets who believed that hidden within this prophetic book of gossip, there would be hints of what those future secrets would turn out to be. Richard arched an eyebrow. You mean these sisters were, in essence, listening to gossip in order to overhear something? Nikki nodded. Something like that.
You see, there were a few sisters who considered this simple book of seeming nonsense to be one of the most important books of prophecy in existence. It was kept under tight security. It was never allowed to leave the vaults for study, as some other volumes of prophecy were. There were sisters who devoted a lot of their spare time to studying this seemingly silly book. Because people don't generally go to the trouble to record gossip, Yankley's Yarns is thought to be the only book of its kind, the only written account of gossip, even if it hadn't happened yet. These sisters believed that there were events that couldn't be discovered or studied in any other way except through this book, which predated such events. In essence, they believed that they were eavesdropping on whispered gossip about things that would happen in the future, gossip about secret things. They believed that Yankley's Yarns held invaluable clues to secrets unknown to anyone else or in any other way. Richard pressed his fingertips to his forehead as he tried to take it all in. You said that there were sisters devoted to studying this book. Do you happen to know who any of these sisters were?
Nicky nodded slowly. Sister Ulysia.
Oh, great, Richard muttered. Berdine opened a glass door to one of the bookshelves and pulled a volume off the shelf. She turned back and showed the book's cover to Richard and Nicky. The title was Yankley's Yarns. When I read in Colo's journal about the half-wits from Yankley's Yarns, that name was so odd that it kind of stuck in the back of my mind. You know what I mean? Then, one day, I was in here doing research, and this book's title jumped out at me. I didn't realize it was a book of prophecy, like you said, Nicky.
Nicky shrugged with one shoulder. Some books of prophecy are hard to recognize as prophecy, especially for someone not trained in such things. Such important volumes can appear to be simply boring records, or, in the case of Yankley's Yarns, nothing more than trivial nonsense.
The dean indicated the bookshelves lining the small room. Except there would hardly be anything trivial in this room.
Good point, Richard said.
Berdine smiled, pleased that he recognized the value of her reasoning. She set the book down on the table that occupied the center of the small library and carefully opened the cover. She leafed through the fragile pages until she found the place she wanted. She looked up at each of them in turn. Since Colo had mentioned this book, I thought I ought to read it. It was really boring, nearly put me to sleep. It didn't appear of any importance at all, she tapped a page, until I spotted this, here. This really woke me up. Richard twisted his head to read the words above her finger. He had to work at it a moment to figure out the meaning of the passage written in High Dharan. He scratched his temple as he translated aloud. So nervous will be the meddling half-wits to copy the key that should never be copied, that they will tremble in fear at what they have done, and cast the shadow of the key among the bones, never to reveal that only one key was cut true. The hair at the back of Richard's neck stood on end. Kara folded her arms across her breasts. So you mean to say that you think that when it came right down to the deed itself, and they made the copies, they turned chicken and made all but one copy a fake?
Berdine drew her hand down her long braid of glossy brown hair.
It would appear so. Richard was still lost in the words. Cast the shadow of the key among the bones. He looked up at Berdine. Hid them in the central sites. Buried them with the bones.
Berdine smiled.
It's so good to have you back, Lord Rawl. You and I think just alike. I've missed you so much. There have been so many things like this I've wanted to go over with you.
Richard laid an arm gently around her shoulders, revealing a similar sentiment without using the words.
Berdine turned over more pages in the book, finally stopping in a place that was blank. A number of the books seemed to have text missing, like this place here.
Prophecy, Nicky said. It's part of the Chainfire spell that the Sisters of the Dark used on Richard's wife. The spell also eliminated prophecy related to her existence.
Berdine considered Nicky's words. That certainly is going to make it all more difficult. It takes away a lot of information that might be useful. Verna had mentioned that there was copy missing from books of prophecy, but she didn't know the reason. Nicky glanced around at the shelves.
Show me all the books you know of with text missing.
Richard wondered why Nicky looked so suspicious. Verdine opened several of the glass doors and pulled out volumes, handing them each in turn to Nicky. Nicky scanned them briefly, then dismissively set them on the table. "Prophecy," she pronounced yet again as she tossed the last one Verdine handed her on the pile. "What are you getting at?" Richard asked. Instead of answering him, she looked at Verdine. "Any more with missing text?" Verdine nodded. "There is one more." She glanced briefly at Richard, then pushed a row of books out of her way. At the back of a shelf, she drew a panel aside. A small section of the wall opened to reveal a gilded niche with a small book setting on a dark green velvet pillow with golden fringe. The leather cover looked to have once been red, but was now so faded and worn that the bits of faint color only hinted at its past glory. It was a delicately beautiful book, intriguing partly because of its small size, and partly because of the ornate decorative leatherwork. "I used to help Lord Rawl, I mean Darkin Rawl, work on translations of books in High Dharan," Verdine explained. "This room was one of the places he would study his private books. That's how I knew where to find the key and about this secret compartment in the back of the bookcase. I really thought it might be something useful."
"And was it?" Richard asked.
"I thought it would be, but I'm afraid not. It, too, is missing text. Except, unlike those other books, this one isn't just missing some of the text here and there or missing whole sections. Instead, this book is missing every single word. It's completely empty."
"It's missing every word?" Nicky asked suspiciously. "Let me see it."
Verdine handed the little book over to Nicky. "It's completely blank, I'm telling you. See for yourself, it's useless."
Nicky opened the ancient worn leather cover and scanned the first page. Her finger followed along as if she were reading. She flipped the page and studied the next, then did the same thing yet again.
"Dear spirits," she whispered as she appeared to read.
"What is it?" Richard asked.
Verdine stretched up on her tiptoes and peeked over the top of the book. "It can't be anything. See, it's blank."
"No, it's not," Nicky murmured as she read. "This is a book of magic." She looked up.
"It only appears blank to those without the gift. And in the case of this particular work, even they must possess the gift in sufficient strength to be able to read this. This is a profoundly important volume."
Verdine wrinkled her nose.
"What?"
"Books of magic are dangerous, some exceedingly dangerous. Some, such as this one, are beyond even that." Nicky waggled the book at the moored Sith.
"This one is far more than profoundly dangerous. As a form of protection, such books are usually shielded in some way. If they are considered dangerous enough, then they are protected with spells that make the text vanish from a person's mind so quickly that they don't recall seeing it. It makes them think the pages are blank. A person without the gift simply can't hold the words of a book of magic in their mind. You actually do see the words in this book, but you forget seeing them so fast that you aren't cognizant that there was anything on the pages. The words vanish from your mind before you actually perceive them. That particular spell is, in part, the basis for the concept of the chainfire spell. The wizards in ancient times, who often used such spells to protect dangerous books they wrote, began to wonder if such a thing could be done with a person, in effect making them vanish, just as the words in some books of magic can seem to vanish." Nicky gestured vaguely as her attention drifted back to the book. "Of course, when a soul is involved, it complicates the whole matter beyond words." Richard had long ago learned that he had been able to memorize the Book of Counted Shadows only because he was gifted. Zed had told him that if he hadn't had the gift, he wouldn't have been able to hold the words in his mind long enough to have remembered a single one.
"So, what is this book about?" he asked.
Nicky finally pulled her gaze away from the pages and looked up. "This is a book of magic instruction."
"I know, you said that already," he said patiently. "Instruction for what?"
Nicky checked the page again and swallowed as she again gazed into his eyes.
"I think this is the original instruction book for putting the boxes of Warden in play."
Richard felt goosebumps yet again tingle up his arms and legs. He gently lifted the book from Nicky's hands. Sure enough, it was not blank at all. Every page was packed with small written words, diagrams, charts, and formulas. "This is in High Dhaharan." He looked up at Nicky. "You mean to say you can read High Dhaharan?" "Of course." Richard shared a look with Badin. He could see immediately that the book was profoundly complex. He had learned High Dhaharan, but this book was something only on the brink of his understanding. "This is far more technical than the High Dhaharan I'm used to reading," he said as he scanned the pages. Nicky leaned close and pointed to a place on the page he was staring at. "This here is all reference material to formulas needed in incantations. You have to know the formulas and spells to really understand it." Richard looked up into her blue eyes. "And do you?" She twisted her mouth as she frowned at the page. "I don't know. I'd have to study it at length to know if I can be of any help in translating it." Badin again stretched up on her tiptoes and peered into the book, as if checking to see if maybe the words might now appear to her. "Why can't you tell right away? I mean, either you can read it and understand it, or you can't." Nicky raked the fingers of one hand back through her blonde hair as she took a deep breath. "It's not that simple with books of magic. It's kind of like doing complex mathematical equations. You may know the numbers and at first think you know what it's about, that you can work the equation. But if you then discover unknown symbols buried in the equation, symbols that refer to things unfamiliar to you, then the entire equation is pretty much unworkable. Just knowing some of the numbers isn't enough. You have to know what every element means, or at least how to find the value or quantity it represents. This is much the same, although I'm simplifying it so that you can understand my point. In this, there are not just symbols, but obsolete references to spells, making it all the more difficult to understand. Being in High Dhaharan makes it worse yet, because over time High Dhaharan words and their meaning have changed. Added to that, this text is an ancient argot form." Richard gripped her arm, drawing her attention. "Nicky, this is important. Do you think you can manage to do it?" She looked hesitantly at the book. "It will take some time before I can translate enough to be able to tell you if I have a chance of being successful." Richard took the book out of her hands, closed it, and handed it back to her. "Then you'd better take it with you. When we have more time, you can study it and see if you can figure it out." She frowned suspiciously. "Why, what are you thinking?" "Nicky, don't you see? This could be our answer. If you can translate it, understand it, then what's in here might provide us with a way to counter, reverse, or dismantle what Sister Ulysia did. With this, maybe we can take the Boxes of Warden back out of play." Nicky gently rubbed her thumb over the cover of the little book. "That sounds like it makes sense, Richard. But knowing how to do something doesn't mean that you can undo it."
"Kind of like trying to get yourself unpregnant?"
Kara asked. Nicky smiled. "Something like that." Kara's unexpected analogy threw Richard's mind back to Kaelin, and when she had been pregnant. A gang of men had caught her alone and beaten her nearly to death. She lost her and Richard's child. Her pregnancy ended before he'd even known about it. The memory of seeing Kaelin so grievously hurt nearly buckled his knees. He had to force the ghastly thoughts back into the blackness from where they'd come. Nicky's brow twitched with a frown, apparently at seeing the anguish in his face. He ignored her unspoken worry for him. "I don't need to remind you how important this is," he said. She held him in her gaze for a long moment, as if wanting to tell him that it was impossible, but desperately not wanting to say no to him. She finally pressed her lips tight and nodded. "I'll do my best, Richard." Her expression suddenly brightened. She flipped to the end of the book and hurriedly turned back the last page. She stood absorbed for a moment as she scrutinized the final page. "This is interesting," she murmured. "What?" Richard asked. Nicky looked up from the middle of what she was reading. "Well, at the end of some books of magic, as a precaution against unauthorized use, they will occasionally have some final step that's essential but not included. If so, then, even if the boxes are already in play, we might be able to interrupt the series of specific actions required. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes, if the book is dangerous enough, it won't be complete in and of itself, but will require something else to complete it.
Something else? Like what?
I don't know. That's what I'm checking.
She held up a finger.
Let me read just a little of this part.
After a moment, she looked up as she tapped the page.
Yes, I was right.
This warns that to use this book, the key must be used. Otherwise, without the key, everything that has come before will not only be sterile, but fatal. It says that within one full year, the key must complete what has been wrought with this book.
Key, Richard repeated in a flat tone. He glanced to Badin.
They will tremble in fear at what they have done and cast the shadow of the key among the bones, she quoted from Yankley's yarns. You think that could be the key this book is talking about?
Something stirred in the dark fringes of his consciousness.
With a lightning-swift spark of comprehension, Richard understood.
His whole body flashed icy cold. His arms and legs went numb.
Dear spirits, he whispered.
Nicky frowned at him. Richard, what's wrong? You've gone as pale as chalk. Richard had trouble making his voice work. Finally, he heard himself say, I've got to get back to Zed.
Nicky reached out and laid a hand on his arm.
What's wrong?
I think I know what the key is. Richard began to pant as his heart pounded out of control. Everything he knew was turning upside down, and all the pieces were coming apart. It felt like he couldn't get his breath. They will tremble in fear at what they have done and cast the shadow of the key among the bones.
Well, what do you think? I'll explain it when we get there. We have to go, now.
Worried, Nicky slipped the book into a pocket in the black skirt of her dress.
I'll do my best, Richard. I'll figure this out, I promise.
He nodded absently as his mind raced to try to fit all the pieces back together. He felt as if he were only watching himself begin to move. He seized Badin by the arm.
Barakas had a secret place, a library. I need you to try to find out where it was.
Badin nodded at his urgency. All right, Lord Rawl. I'll see what I can learn. I'll do my best.
She glanced down at the white knuckles on his hand, gripping her arm. Richard realized that he must be hurting her and let go.
Thank you, Badin. I know I can count on you.
The others were all staring at him. I've got to get back to Zed. I've got to talk to him right away. I've got to know where he got it.
Got what?
Nicky pressed a hand to his chest, stopping him before he went through the door.
Richard, what's so important that...
Look, I'll explain it when we get back, he said, cutting her off. Right now, I need to think this through.
Nicky shared a troubled look with Kara.
All right, Richard. Calm down. We'll be back to the keep soon enough.
He snatched a fistful of Kara's red leather outfit and pushed her through the doorway ahead of him.
Get us back to the slip, the shortest route.
All business now. Kara spun her ajeel up into her fist.
Come on, then.
He turned back to Badin, trotting backward after Kara.
I need you to find out everything you possibly can about Barakas. Everything.
Badin raced along just ahead of Nicky.
I will, Lord Rawl.
He pointed back at her.
Verna will be here soon. Tell her that I said I need her to help you. Have her sisters help you, too. Go through every book in the entire palace if you have to, but find out everything you can about Barakas, where he was born, where he grew up, what he liked, what he didn't. He was first wizard, so there should be information of some kind. I want to know who cut his hair, who made his clothes, what his favorite color was, everything, no matter how trivial you think it is. While you're at it, see if you can find out anything more about what the half-wits from Yankley's yarns did.
Don't worry, Lord Rawl. If there is information to be had, I will have it. I'll figure it out and have an answer when you return.
Richard snatched Nicky's hand to make sure she kept up, and then turned toward Kara.
Hurry!
Badin, a jeel in her fist, ran after them, guarding the rear.
Richard was only dimly aware of the flashes of light off polished armor and weapons, and the jangle of gear, as the soldiers took up the chase as if the keeper himself were after the Lord Rawl.
As his mind raced as fast as his feet, Richard resolved that he had better go to Casca first. The more he considered that idea, and as the pieces of the puzzle started fitting together, he reconsidered the idea. With the Slif, he could travel swiftly back to Casca from the keep. It was more urgent that he get to Zed.
As they ran through the labyrinth of halls, rooms, and passageways, Richard heard the distant toll of the bell, calling people to the devotion to the Lord Rahl. He wondered if they would all soon be kneeling before the Keeper of the Underworld and saying their devotions to him.
Chapter 30. Six abruptly stood. Without a word, she took three long strides to the wall of the cave that held Violet's expansive drawing. The woman carefully pressed her bony hands against the chalk symbols that Violet had drawn there days before. Those symbols had suddenly begun to glow, the yellow chalk glowing with yellow light, the red chalk with red light, and the blue with blue light. The eerie illumination from the flaring colors shimmered over the walls of the cave the way light reflected off rippling water. Rachel glanced over at Violet, sitting on a squat, purple, tufted stool she'd had Rachel carry in for her days before. The bored queen picked with her fingernail at flaking stone on the wall behind her. Rachel had come to think of Violet as the queen of the cave, since that was where they spent more and more of their time. Violet didn't like sitting on rock when she wasn't drawing. A filthy old rock, she'd said, was more than good enough for Rachel, but not for a queen. Six hadn't cared at all about the stool. She appeared to always have more consequential matters on her mind than cushions for sitting. Violet, though, got tired of waiting while Six thought about those consequential matters, and so she'd had Rachel lug the heavy stool to the cave. Now the queen of the cave, under the flickering light of torches and glowing symbols, sat upon her tufted purple throne, waiting for her adviser to advise her as to what needed to be done next.
"He comes," Six hissed. "Again he comes through the void."
It was clear to Rachel that the woman wasn't really talking to Violet, but to herself. The queen might as well not have been there. Violet glanced up. She didn't look inclined to bother to stand unless Six told her that it was necessary that she do more drawings. But it was clear that her interest had been roused. This was, after all, what she wanted. And the whole reason she bothered to go to all the work of making such complex drawings down in a dank and dingy cave, when she could just as well be trying on dresses and jewels or attending grand feasts where guests fawned over the young queen. Six seemed in a world of her own, as her hands glided over the drawing. She put the side of her face against the stone, and at the same time reached an arm back. "Come, my child." A scowl creased Violet's round features.
"You mean my queen."
Six either didn't hear her or didn't care to correct herself.
"Hurry, it is time to begin the lynx."
Violet stood.
"Now? It's long past dinner time. I'm starving."
Six, stroking her cheek against the chalk drawing of Richard like a cat rubbing the side of its face against a person's legs, didn't seem at all interested in dinner. She rolled her long fingers, beckoning Violet.
"It must be now. Hurry. We must not waste such a rare opportunity. Such links as we need will take time, and there is no telling how much time we may have."
"Well, then, why didn't we begin earlier when the—"
"It must be started now, when he is in the void."
Six clawed the air with one hand.
"Easier to scratch his eyes out when he's blind," she said in her hissy voice.
"I don't see what—"
"The way is the way. Do you wish this or not?"
Violet's folded arms, along with her defiance, came undone. Her expression took on a dark set.
"I do."
A sinuous smile slipped across Six's features.
"Then let it begin. You must now complete the links."
Looking suddenly resolute, Violet plucked the sticks of colored chalk off a little ledge in the stone wall behind her royal stool. As she strode up beside Six, the woman tapped a long, thin finger to the stone.
"Begin at the sign of the dagger, as I've taught you. Just as you've practiced, to ensure that at the initiation of the link, what you have wrought will be ready to slice swift and sure.
I know, Violet said as she boldly touched the tip of the yellow chalk to the point of one of the elaborate glowing symbols off to the side of Richard. Six snatched Violet's wrist, pulling her hand back just enough to lift the chalk away from the wall. She moved Violet's hand over a few inches, then let the chalk again touch the symbol, but at the next apex in a design with a perimeter comprised of dozens of points.
I told you,
Six said with strained civility as she helped Violet begin the line, a mistake here will last us for eternity.
I know, I just got the wrong apex point, that's all, Violet huffed. I've got it now.
Six, ignoring the queen, her gaze fixed on the drawing, nodded approvingly as she watched the chalk begin to move across the stone.
Change to red,
Six prompted in a low voice after Violet had pulled the chalk a few inches across the open distance. Without argument or hesitation, Violet changed the chalk for the red one, and started it moving at an angle from the yellow line she had already drawn. After bringing it half the remaining distance toward the drawing of Richard, she stopped without needing to be told, and switched to the blue chalk. She hesitated then, and glanced up at Six.
This is the node, right?
Six was already nodding. That's right, she murmured, pleased with what she was seeing. That's right, take it around and back now to complete the first ligature. Violet drew a blue circle at the end of the red line before crossing the empty place on the smooth, dark stone wall. When the blue chalk reached one of the points on the next symbol, she went back and drew a line from the circle to connect to Richard. The completed triad of lines Violet had just drawn began to glow. The blue circle ignited with a beam of light, as if it were a beacon coming through a window in the dark stone. Six abruptly held up a hand, commanding that Violet stop before she could put the chalk to the next point in the sequence.
What's wrong?
Violet asked.
Something is not right.
Six pressed the side of her face to the drawing, this time laying her cheek right atop Richard's face.
Not right at all.
Richard drew another silvered breath of the ecstasy. But with his urgent worries overriding the experience, it was something short of the remarkable essence of rapture that he usually experienced within the Slough. He realized, though, that when he traveled in the Slough he was usually gravely troubled by something. After all, trouble of one sort or another was why he traveled in the Slough in the first place. Still, it had never before felt this way. This feeling was not dread so much as it was a sense of the great but intangible weight of foreboding. With every breath, that phantom weight pressed in on him ever more. Within the Slough there was no real sense of vision, as such, just as there was no real sense of time, or up or down. Even so, there was a semblance of sight. There were colors and, on occasion, obscure shapes that seemed to loom up and just as quickly vanish. There was also a visual perception of the phenomenon of mind-bending speed that made him feel as if he were nothing more than an arrow fired from a powerful bow. At the same time, there was a feeling of almost floating motionless within the thick void of the Slough. Those different sensations mixed together created a heady mix of the whole of the experience that suspended his urge to separate them into constituent parts. As he raced through the quicksilver essence of the Slough, he began to discount his anxiety. It was then that Richard felt the faint brush of an odd sensation against his skin, a stealthy pressure that he instantly recognized as a sensation he had never before experienced as he traveled, tingling apprehension rippling through him. Foreboding, he realized, was not tangible in the way that this touch had been. As he drifted, held in the embrace of the vast silver emptiness, he tried to separate the perception of having been touched from everything else. Richard felt the placid isolation of the Slough surrounding him, caressing him, insulating him from the terrible headlong rush of speed that otherwise seemed as if it would surely have to tear a person apart.
He still felt the balm of serenity quelling his fear of breathing into his lungs the liquid in which he floated. But Richard felt something else. Even if he was not yet able to set the troubling sensation apart from all others enough to define it. With growing conviction, though, he was sure that something was wrong. Frighteningly wrong. It was all the more disturbing because he couldn't understand how he knew that something was imperfect. He worked to comprehend why he would think such a thing. It had to have been, he decided, that furtive touch. He briefly wondered if he could have imagined it, but then discounted the notion. He had felt it. It seemed almost as if he were in the presence of an unholy taint, like lying in a warm, sunlit meadow on a beautiful day, surrounded by the cascade of colors and balmy aroma of wild flowers, watching cottony clouds slowly drift through a bright blue sky, and then catching the first faint whiff of a decomposing carcass, while at the same time realizing that the vague sound you heard was the buzzing of flies. What ordinarily seemed like a timeless spell spent racing through the smoothly silver slough had begun to drag out into an agonizing suspension of headway. Kara already had his right hand in an iron grip, but Nicky gripped his left hand even more tightly. He could tell in that urgent squeeze that she sensed something as well. He wished that he could ask her what she felt, but talking within the slough was not possible. Richard opened his eyes wider, trying to see more of what was around him. But it was a muted, murky world where there was little to be seen, other than the shimmering shafts of light, yellow, red, blue, piercing the gloom through which they raced. Richard didn't think that those shafts of light were moving as they once had been. It was hard to tell such things for sure within the slough, though. It was generally a hazy sense of events rather than actual perception. There was something out ahead of him, Richard realized. Something maneuvering fluidly through the silver obscurity. At first it looked like long, slender petals just beginning to blossom open. As it came closer, Richard saw that it looked more like numerous arms, tapered, long, undulating objects, fanning open from a central element that for some reason he could not quite figure out. It was disorienting to watch because it was so incomprehensible. As it came ever closer, it began to appear to Richard as if, whatever it was made up of segments of glass, all assembled into something orderly, something billowing open before him. He could see through the transparent, expanding arms, see the shafts of color and light shimmering beyond. It was the oddest thing he had ever seen. As hard as he tried, he simply could not make sense of it. It was like it was there, but not there. And then, with icy dread, comprehension washed through him. At the same time, Nicky pulled his hand so hard that it nearly wrenched his arm right out of its socket. The yank must have pulled him back because Kara, still holding his other hand, sailed around him as if falling through midair. Richard ducked. The translucent shape whipped past his face, just missing him. Nicky had pulled him back just in time. Richard knew now what it was. It was the beast. The sense of being in the presence of evil was suddenly so strong that it engulfed him with suffocating panic. As the beast, like some temporal vision, skimmed past him, it twisted around. The glassy arms fanned open as they reached out and again tried to snatch him. With a sharp tug, Nicky again drew him back from the star-shaped net of tentacles spread wide before him. Again they tried to close around him. Richard pulled his hand away from Kara's and drew his knife. With her now free hand, she immediately snatched a fistful of his shirt to hold on to him. Richard did his best to slash at the ever-reaching arms, trying to embrace him in their deadly grasp. It didn't take long to realize that fighting with a knife within the slough was close to impossible. It was too fluid an environment for Richard to be able to strike with any speed. It was like trying to maneuver in honey. He changed his tactics and instead waited for the arms to draw in around him, waited for whatever was at the glassy center to come to him. When they did, He drove the blade toward the aware center of the translucent threat. Rather than be impaled on the blade, though, the creature only seemed to fold around Richard's knife and twist effortlessly away. And then it again came into attack, now with a kind of abrupt, intent fury that Richard could sense. The thing moved with a fluid grace that didn't seem to be hindered at all by the fluid world surrounding them. To one side, Richard saw the shimmering shape of Kara, still gripping his shirt as she tried to attack the beast with her free hand. To the other side, he knew, Nikki was trying to work magic. It didn't seem that her magic was working in the environment of the slit. One of the beast's arms coiled around Richard's arm. Another lashed around Kara's. She seized his wrist with her other hand. The beast fastened onto her other arm as well and effortlessly ripped the two of them apart. In an instant, Kara was gone. In the murky darkness, Richard couldn't tell where she was or how close she might be. Worse, he didn't know if she was all right or if the creature had her. Nikki tightened her arm protectively around Richard's waist, holding on for dear life, as more of the undulating, transparent arms came out of the gloom and coiled around them. It was like getting tangled in a nest of snakes, all entwining themselves and constricting with great force once attached. The one around Richard's leg drew so tight that he thought it would surely rip his flesh from the bone. Even though Richard could not hear Nikki in the conventional sense, he could perceive her muffled cries of fury as she fought the thing that had snared them. An odd, muted form of lightning flickered madly around Nikki. Richard knew she was trying to use her power, but it wasn't having any effect on the beast. Richard ignored the pain of the glassy tentacles that already had him, and stabbed over and over, cutting into thick arms that looked to be only partly there. With determined and focused rage, he slashed with the knife and was able to cleave some of the arms away from the core of the thing. Once severed, they writhed wildly as they fell away into the void around them, as if sinking into a bottomless sea. It seemed to do no good. Ever more of the twisting tentacles came at him from out of the darkness. It was like finding himself at the bottom of a dark pit full of angry vipers. Richard fought on with all his strength, cutting, stabbing, slashing. His arms ached with the effort. Nikki grappled with the thick tentacles with one hand, her other arm still refusing to let him go. He could tell by the way she arched and twisted that she was in agony. Richard abandoned the coils around himself, and with all his fury hacked at the arms of the beast, hurting Nikki as they tried to pull her away from him. But then she was violently torn away from him. Richard was suddenly alone in the middle of nowhere with a glassy, slippery, powerful creature trying to wrestle him in toward its center, toward something he could hear snarling, snapping, clacking. There was no way to fight such a thing, no way to get an advantage over its power, no way to escape its multi-armed grasp. Ever more of the arms whipped in to capture him. With all his strength, before his arm was captured, he thrust the knife toward the center mass that he couldn't clearly see. He made solid contact. The beast howled with a sound that hurt his ears. The arms loosened just a bit, not letting go of him, but loosed just enough for Richard to give a mighty twist of his body that succeeded in spinning him out of the creature's grip. In an instant, like a pumpkin seed squeezed between wet fingers, he squirted away from the deadly grip. Richard tried to swim away, to somehow escape the thrashing, translucent arms coming for him. But it was faster than he was, more powerful, and tireless. "Here," Six urged as she wrapped her knuckles against the center of an emblem. Violet raced with the chalk to the spot her advisor was urging her toward. Her fingers flew with swift and sure movements. With the back of her other hand, Violet swiped sweat off her face, then with her fingers wiped it from her eyes. Rachel had never seen Violet work so hard or so fast. Rachel didn't know what was happening, but it was obvious that something was not going the way Six had expected. She was in a state balancing precariously between panic and rage. Rachel feared whichever way it fell. While Violet swiftly completed links, switching chalk and moving to each successive point, Six went back to softly chanting her incantations. The corrosive sound of those whispered words felt as if they were searing Rachel's soul. While she could not understand the words or their meaning, they were spoken with a sinister intent that terrified her. She glanced toward the distant cave entrance, but with it being dark outside, Rachel couldn't see anything. She wanted to run, but dared not. She knew that if she caused Violet or Six to have to stop what they were doing and come after her, it would go very badly for her. Chase had taught her to bridle her impulses, as he'd called it, and to watch for true openings. He had cautioned her that if she wasn't in immediate mortal danger, she should only act when she had a deliberate plan that she had thought out ahead of time. He said that she shouldn't act out of blind fear, but work to find ways to increase the odds of success. Despite how busy the other two were, Rachel knew that with both of them together, and both in such a frantic state, they both would react to any misdeed by Rachel with swift and unrestrained violence. This was not the right opportunity. Getting up right then and running was not a good plan, and she knew it. As Rachel sat still and quiet, trying to keep from being noticed, Six gently tapped the side of her fist against several of the flaring nodes in the links Violet had already drawn. Each bright circle she tapped went dark, with a low growling sound that ran a shiver up Rachel's spine. The cave seemed to hum with the rise and fall of Six's rhythmic conjuring. Violet, drawing with bold, slashing strokes, glanced to the side, checking on Six's progress. Six, extinguishing the beacons in sequence, was catching up with the queen. Violet, as if in a trance, drew faster. The chalk made a clack, clack, clacking sound with each line that Violet threw down against the stone. The sound of the chalk matched the rhythm of Six's chant. All around the figure of Richard, Six, conjuring with murmured verses spoken in a rising, sing-song chant that gradually brought a howling wind swirling down into the cave, wrapped the side of her fist against points in the links Violet had been drawing without pause for hours. Rachel had thought that Violet might soon collapse from exhaustion, but far from it, she seemed to be working herself into a fever pitch of effort, trying to stay ahead of Six. Despite how swiftly her hand moved, each line Violet drew looked true. Each intersection met accurately and completely. Six had made Violet practice endlessly drawing the symbols, and now it seemed to be paying off. The drawing of Richard was almost completely encased in the web of symbols and connecting lines. With a strange word, shouted in order to be heard over the howling wind, Six extinguished the final beacon around the figure of Richard. The wind abruptly died. Little pieces of leaves and other debris fluttered down through the abruptly still air. Six paused in her chanting. Her brow twitched. With her fingertips, she touched several of the symbols, as if feeling their pulse. Shimmers of colored light flickering through the cave. "It has him," Six whispered to herself. Violet paused, swallowing as she caught her breath. "What?" "Apogee to inferior apex." She turned a venomous look on a startled Violet.
"Do it!"
Without hesitation, Violet turned back to the wall and reached up, drawing coiled lines downward from one of the central elements above Richard's head. Six lifted a hand. "Be ready, but don't touch the primary invocation points until I tell you." Violet nodded. Six's eyes rolled back in her head as she leaned in on her fingertips over the figure of Richard. As Violet and Rachel watched, Six breathed a low murmur of strange words. Chapter 31. Nikki broke above the quicksilver surface of the sliff. The weight of the leaden liquid rolled from her hair and face. Colors and light seemed to explode out of the quiet, mellow darkness. "Breathe." With all her effort, Nikki immediately forced the silver fluid from her lungs. "Breathe." With her need overwhelming her dread, she gasped a desperate breath. It burned like drawing in acidic vapors. The room spun sickeningly in her vision. Nikki saw a smear of red. She floundered woodenly as she again gasped. She managed to reach the edge and throw an arm over the sliff's stone wall to hold herself up. Panic threatened to swamp her. A hand seized her arm. Nikki managed to heave her pack up and over the wall. Another hand reached down and helped to haul her up enough for her to get both arms over the wall of the sliff. The red she had seen was Kara. "Where's Lord Rawl?" Nikki blinked up at the moored Sith's intense blue eyes. She had never known blue to hurt so much. She closed her eyes and shook her head, still trying to clear her mind of the experience, of the confusion, of the ringing sound of Kara's voice echoing through the marrow of her bones. "Richard." It felt as if her insides twisted with the anguish of wanting nothing so much as to help him. "Richard." Kara grunted with the effort of lifting Nikki's dead weight and pulling the top half of her body the rest of the way up and out of the well. Nikki, feeling like the survivor of a shipwreck in a stormy sea, slid out over the top of the stone wall, unable to do much to contribute to her own rescue. Kara put one knee to the floor, catching Nikki before her limp body hit the stone. Once Kara had lowered her down onto the stone floor, Nikki gathered all her strength and pushed herself up on trembling arms. She couldn't seem to muster her usual strength. It was a frightful feeling, not being able to make her body do her bidding. With great effort, she finally managed to tip herself upright and sit heavily back against the wall of the sliff's well. She still gasped, trying to catch her breath. She still hurt everywhere. For a moment she slumped against the stone well, trying to gather her strength. Kara seized her by the collar of her dress and shook her. "Nikki, where's Lord Rawl?" Nikki blinked, looking around, trying to make sense of everything. She hurt so much. The pain reminded her of one of Jagang's beatings, the way during his rage she would start to feel the pain through a half-numb fog of confusion. But this had not been the Emperor's doing. This was pain from something that had happened in the sliff. Traveling had never hurt before. It had never been a painful experience. "Where's Lord Rawl?" Nikki winced at the ache of the shout echoing around the room. She swallowed past the raw pain in her throat. "I don't know." She put her elbows on her knees and ran her fingers back into her hair, holding her pounding head in both hands. "Dear spirits, I don't know." Kara leaned over the well so fast and so hard that Nikki thought she might topple in. Instinctively, she reached out to catch the moored Sith's legs, thinking that she would surely fall in, but she didn't. "Sliff!" Kara's shout again echoed around the ancient, dusty stone room. Nikki shared the emotion, but knew that the intensity would not accomplish anything. Ignoring the searing pain in her joints, she staggered to her feet. The spinning feeling was slowing a little. She saw the quicksilver form of the sliff's face partly emerge from the well, her features forming in the glossy surface to look up at them. "Where's Lord Rawl?" Kara asked. The sliff chose to ignore Kara's question. Instead, she peered over at Nikki. "You must not ever do that when you are within me," the eerie voice echoed softly around the room. "You mean magic?" Nikki guessed. "I have great difficulty being able to endure such power being unleashed within me, but such a thing could be worse for you and anyone else traveling at the same time. You must not ever try to use your ability when you travel. It will make you sick at the least. It could easily turn out far worse. It is dangerous to all."
"She's right about that," Kara said confidentially. "When you started doing that, it hurt like an agile was being used on me. My legs still don't work right."
"Mine either," Nikki admitted. "But I couldn't very well just let the beast have Richard without trying to protect him, now could I?" Ill at ease for even giving the hint of an impression that she wouldn't have done anything to protect Richard, Kara shook her head. "I would have taken far worse than that to protect Lord Rawl.
You did the right thing. I don't care what the sliff says.
Me too, Nikki said. At that moment, though, she wasn't concerned about herself or Kara. She turned to the sliff.
Where is Richard? What happened to him? Where is he?
I cannot...
Kara's patience, if she'd had any, was gone. She lunged for the sliff as if she was going to try to strangle its silver neck. Where is he?
The face glided out of reach. Nikki snatched Kara's outfit and pulled the woman back, standing her up on the floor beside her. Her face, red with rage, nearly matched her leather outfit.
Sliff, this is vital, Nikki said, trying to sound reasonable. We were with Richard, with Lord Rawl, your master, when we were attacked. That's why I had to use my power. I was trying to protect him. That beast is extremely dangerous.
The flawless silver face distorted into a fearful cast.
I know. It hurt me.
Nikki paused in astonishment.
The beast hurt you?
The sliff nodded. Reflections of the room bent and flowed in twisting shapes over the smooth contours of the statuesque silver features. Nikki stared in wonder as shimmering quicksilver tears formed along the lower lid of the sliff's eyes and rolled down the glossy surface of her cheeks.
It hurt. It did not want to travel.
The silver brow wrinkled with what looked like indignation layered atop torment.
It had no right to use me in that way. It hurt me.
Nikki shared a look with Kara. Kara may have looked surprised, but she did not look sympathetic. The truth be told, at that moment Nikki's worry for Richard took precedence over any other concern.
Sliff, I'm sorry, Nikki said, but where is he? Kara growled. Just tell us where Lord Rawl is.
The sliff hesitated.
He no longer travels.
Where is he then? Kara repeated.
The sliff's voice turned cold and distant.
I never reveal information about others who have been with me.
He's not just a traveler! Kara screamed in rage. It's Lord Rawl!
The sliff backed to the far wall of her well. Nikki held a hand up toward Kara, urging a little restraint and for her to be quiet a moment.
We were attacked by something evil when we were traveling together. You know that.
Nikki tried to calm some of the menace in her voice. She knew, though, that she wasn't being altogether successful. Her rising panic about Richard was making it difficult to think. That and Jebra's frantic warning that they must not allow Richard to be alone, even for an instant.
Sliff, that evil thing was after your master. After Richard. We're Richard's friends. You know that, too. He needs our help. Lord Rawl may be hurt, Kara added.
Nikki nodded her confirmation to Kara's words. We need to get to him. The quiet in the stone room felt painful. Nikki was still trying to accustom herself to being back, still struggling to suppress the agony of pain twisting through her while trying to think what to do next.
We need to get to Richard, she repeated.
The silver face rose up a little farther, drawing a neck of silver fluid up out of the well with her. She puzzled at Nikki.
You wish to travel?
Nikki kept a tight rein on her rage.
Yes, that's right. We wish to travel.
Kara, taking the cue from Nikki, gestured down into the well.
Yes, that's right. We wish to travel.
I won't use my magic in you again, I promise.
Nikki motioned the sliff closer. We wish to travel. Right away. Right now.
The sliff brightened, as if all was forgiven.
You will be pleased.
She seemed eager to satisfy.
Come, we will travel.
Nikki put a knee up on the wall. Her thighs ached with the effort. She ignored the fiery agony burning through her muscles and joints, and worked to climb up atop the broad stone wall. She was relieved that they had at last found a way to get the sliff to comply, if not by telling them where Richard was, then by taking them to him.
Yes, we will travel, Nikki said, still trying to catch her breath.
The sliff formed an arm, slipping it around Nikki's waist, helping to pull her up onto the wall.
Come then. Where do you wish to travel?
To where Lord Rawl is. Kara clambered up onto the wall beside Nikki. Take us there. she said, putting on a smile for the Sliff's benefit. "And we will be pleased." The Sliff paused and gazed at her. The arm drew back, melting into the slowly sloshing surface. The silver face looked suddenly impersonal, even forbidding.
"I cannot reveal information about other clients."
Nikki fisted her hands. "He's not just any client. He's your master, and he's in trouble. He's our friend. You have to take us to him."
The Sliff's reflective face moved away. "I cannot do such a thing."
Nikki and Kara stood mute for a moment, both at their wits' end, unable to think of how to convince the Sliff to cooperate. Nikki felt like screaming, or crying, or unleashing enough magic to boil the Sliff into talking. "If you don't help us," she finally said in an even tone, "then you will feel more pain than you did from the beast. I will see to that. Please don't make me resort to that. We know you want to protect Richard. That's what we're trying to do, too."
The Sliff stared in silence, like a silver statue, as if trying to assess the threat.
Kara pressed her fingers to her temples. "It's like trying to reason with a bucket of water," she muttered. Nikki glared at the Sliff. "You will take us to your master. That's an order." "You'd better do as she says," Kara said. "Or when she's done with you, then you will have to answer to me." The moored Sith spun her Ajeel up into her fist to make her point. But when she did, she suddenly froze stiff, staring at the weapon. The blood drained from her face. Even her hands stood out white against the red leather of her outfit. Nikki leaned closer and laid a hand on Kara's shoulder. "What's wrong?" Kara's hanging jaw finally moved. "It's dead." "What are you talking about?" Kara's blue eyes were filled with unbridled panic. "My Ajeel is dead in my hand. I can't feel it." While Nikki could clearly read the startled dismay in the moored Sith's voice, she didn't understand its source. Having an Ajeel not give her pain hardly seemed like cause for panic. Even so, such naked terror was infectious. "Does that mean something?" Nikki asked, fearing the answer. The Sliff watched from the far side of the well. "The Ajeel is powered through our bond to Lord Rawl, by his gift." She held the weapon out as if in evidence. "If the Ajeel is dead, then so is the Lord Rawl." "Listen, I'll use my power if I have to make the Sliff take us to him. But Kara, don't start jumping to conclusions. We can't know."
"He's not there."
"He's not where?"
"Anywhere."
Still, Kara stared at her slender weapon held up in her trembling fingers. "I can no longer feel the bond." Her liquid blue-eyed gaze turned up to Nikki. "The bond always tells us where the Lord Rawl is. I can no longer feel him. I no longer feel where he is. He's not there. He's not anywhere." A wave of nausea washed through Nikki. She felt faint. Her fingers and toes were going numb. She turned back to the Sliff. It was gone. Nikki leaned over the wall, peering down into the well. In the darkness below, she saw a faint silver glimmer just as it vanished, leaving behind only blackness. She turned back to Kara and seized a fistful of leather at her shoulder. She hopped down off the wall, pulling Kara with her. "Come on. I know someone who can tell us where Richard is." Chapter 32. With Kara at her side, Nikki raced down the torchlit hallway, over elaborately designed carpets that muted their footfalls, past doorways into darkness, past rooms with oil lamps warmly lighting only vacant furniture. The keep, nearly as vast as the mountain that sheltered it beneath its stoic stone shoulders, felt empty and haunted. Nikki had spent decades in the vast complex known as the Palace of the Prophets, which in some ways was reminiscent of the keep. But the palace had been alive with hundreds of people of all kinds living there, from the prelate to the boys who tended the stables. It, too, had been a place of wizards. Wizards in training, anyway. The keep existed for the purposes of man, and yet it stood silent and absent of those who would give it life. If a place could be said to be forlorn, The immense structure of the keep was such a place. Kara ran with all her strength, driven by her loyalty and love for Richard, by dread that the worst had happened to him. Nicky ran just as fast, driven by fear of even considering the possibility that he was dead, as if trying to outrun death itself. She couldn't allow herself to even entertain such a concept, lest she collapse in despair. A world without Richard in it would be a dead world to her. Kara slid across the polished gray marble floor to slow herself enough to make the turn when Nicky hooked a hand on a cold black marble newel post and charged up the wide black granite steps. The windows far above were dark, making them look like black voids in the world. The stairwell, lit by a few glass proximity spheres, rose up through a soaring tower to seemingly impossible heights above them, making Nicky feel as if she were at the very bottom of a very deep stone well. The sounds of their footsteps echoed through the keep, like the haunting whispers of those long-dead souls who had once walked these very halls, climbed these very steps, laughed and loved and lived in this place. At the top of the third run of stairs, Nicky, her legs aching with the frantic effort, led them into a broad passageway. As she ran past the warm, reddish-brown cherry pilasters separating expanses of brightly colored leaded glass, she pointed ahead, letting Kara know that they would be turning at the next hallway to the right. Finally into the network of smaller halls leading to the quarters where they had been staying, Nicky spotted Zed in the distance, marching toward them. Rika followed close on his heels. The old wizard, looking grim as he drew to a halt, waited for them to close the last bit of distance. "What is it?" he asked, apparently knowing by the looks on their faces that something was awry. "Where's Lord Rawl?" Rika demanded as she came to an abrupt halt right behind him. Nicky recognized the anxious look on her face. It was the same look that Kara had worn ever since she discovered that her Ajeel didn't work. Nicky glanced down and saw that Rika was gripping her Ajeel in a white-knuckled fist, the same as Kara. Those talismans of their connection to the Lord Rawl were now dead. "Where's my grandson?" Zed asked, framing it in an anguished, personal tone. "Why isn't he with you?" The last of it sounded like an accusation, as if reminding them of the warning Jebra had given them before they left, and of the promise Nicky had made. "Zed," Nicky began, "we can't say for sure." The wizard cocked his head, his white hair sticking out in disarray. The look he gave her was very much that of a wizard taking charge of the disquieted man. "Don't give me the runaround, child." Had the situation not been so deadly serious, Nicky might have laughed at the characterization. "We were all together in the slit, returning to the keep," Nicky told him. "And somewhere along the way, it's impossible to tell where you are while you're traveling, we were attacked by the beast." Zed glanced to Kara. "The beast." Kara nodded confirmation. "Then what?" "I don't know." Nicky lifted her arms in frustration at trying to find the words to describe the experience. "We tried to fight it off. It had all these snake-like arms. We were grappling with it. I tried to use my Han against it." "In the slith?" "Yes, but it was of little or no help. I was trying everything I could think of. Then the beast just ripped both Kara and me away from Richard. We couldn't find him in the darkness. We tried, but we couldn't find anything, not even each other. Like I said, it's impossible to tell where you are when you're in the slith. You can't see, you can't really hear. It's a confusing kind of place, and try as we might, we just couldn't find Richard." He was looking more angry by the moment. "Then why are you here, instead of in the slith, looking for him?" "The slith spit us out," Kara said. "We found ourselves here, back at the keep. Nicky and I were each trying in our own way to find Lord Rawl, but there was nothing. No beast, no Lord Rawl. Then the slith dumped us out here, at the place where we had all been headed when we were attacked." "What are you doing up here, then?" he asked again in a menacing voice. "Why aren't you back in the slith, searching, or better yet, making the slith tell you where he is?" Nicky saw his hands fisted at his sides. She knew how he felt. She gently grasped his arm. "Zed, the slith wouldn't tell us where he is. Believe me, we tried. It might be possible to get her to do so, I just don't know. But I think I know a better way. Someone who might be able to tell us where Richard is. Jebra. I don't want to waste any more time, and I think Jebra might be able to provide an answer sooner than the Sliff would.
This is the end of disc number 11. Please continue listening on disc number 12.